I'm Lewis Reining with WTJU, and today we're talking with Justin Sean, the author of a book, Surviving the War in Syria, Survival Strategies in a Time of Conflict. Justin Sean is also a postdoctoral research associate with UVA's Democratic Statecraft Lab. For the book, he and a very, very small team performed over 200 interviews with Syrian refugees. 10 months of fieldwork went into this. So this book, as I understand it, is really about exploring that analysis, trying to understand the factors that inform civilian action in areas of conflict. In particular, Justin posits that migration, moving away from the conflict zone, is one of many strategies civilians use to survive. And the book tries to unpack these complex considerations that are being constantly, simultaneously weighed against one another when civilians have to make these decisions. Justin, that was a pretty wordy attempt at a summary. Does that feel like it's a fair opener, or do you feel like there's more that should be said initially before we dive into the specifics?
Absolutely. So, first of all, thank you very much, Lewis, for this interview. I think that's a great way to kick off the conversation. And I think that it's worthwhile to emphasize here that a really important goal that I had in writing this book is to emphasize the agency that civilians possess during conflict. So there's a fairly kind of common move among observers to discuss the behavior of civilians as almost kind of automatic responses to these really powerful, dangerous forces of conflict and violent threat. And I think that it's valuable for us to step back a bit and realize that even amidst really extreme danger, civilians are still trying to live their lives. They are still gathering as much information as they can. They're still making choices. And those choices are not always as simple as we might think.
You hit on one of the things I really wanted to start with, and this will definitely be from a layperson's perspective coming into this book. I definitely had an ignorant thought of like, well, if a civil war were to break out, find its way to Charlottesville, clearly I'd just leave. Obviously, of course, I'd just pack up and go somewhere else. That's the automatic, obvious response. But very clearly, for a number of reasons, the reality is very different for a lot of people, whether by choice or not. It's emotional, economic, social reasons. Can you talk to me about why it isn't automatic? Why it isn't automatic that people just migrate or just make us, you know, there's not a single right consistent choice everybody always makes. What does complicate the decision-making process, or what are some of the things that go into that?
Yeah, so there are a few things to keep in mind here, and I think that the most helpful way to approach this question is to focus on these kinds of micro-level individual logistics that get involved. So first, where you currently live is generally a place that you chose to live in for a reason, or you have chosen not to leave that place for a reason. And so there's generally some degree of kind of baseline resistance to moving when you did not otherwise want to move. Beyond that, if you become motivated to move, we then need to really think about what kinds of opportunities people have to move. So this gets into questions of moving costs money. People have to have money to move, they have to organize that movement. They have to think about how they are going to arrange their transportation. If somebody wants to move internationally, you have to be ready to cross that border, which in some circumstances can be quite difficult, especially if you live in a country experiencing a civil war that already is producing large civilian movements, and neighboring countries might be reticent for a lot of different reasons to just simply welcome people in. And if they make it difficult to cross that international boundary, this adds a level of complication to people thinking about who might want to migrate, about how exactly they're going to make this thing happen.
Since this really gets into the heart of a lot of the research you did, maybe it's best to take a second, because your research was very focused on Syria, the Syrian civil war, and refugees from this civil war and the conflict. What are some of the key concepts, actors, that it would be good for everyone to sort of have a baseline understanding as we get into this discussion that sort of starts to lay out more specifics on the decision-making process?
Yeah, so this is a really helpful spot for us to clarify, because civil war in Syria has a lot of kind of unique characteristics, or really kind of emphasizes various features of civil wars that are quite common, but kind of puts a lot of things at very extreme ends of the spectrum. So to kind of start with a rough timeline in our minds, the start date for the Syrian civil war is generally thought of as being in March of 2011. And I think it's important that we start with that this is just the conventionally understood start date, and that grievances and protests in Syria didn't just start out of nothing in March of 2011. There had been tensions bubbling up for months prior to that. Some protests and demonstrations had been starting. It's just that March of 2011 is when you go from something bubbling to an eruption of large demonstrations. And this protest movement gets met quite quickly with an effort from the Assad regime to violently crack down. And they thought that things would work as they have traditionally worked in Syrian politics, where at any sign of dissent, you crack down hard, crack down brutally, and people will stop, and you will be able to just resume stability. Assad was wrong, and this protest movement grows. It morphs from protest movement into civil war, so that by the time that 2012 hits, this is a full-onset civil war. And by the end of 2012, the Assad regime really felt worried. It felt threatened. And so by the time 2013 hits, you see an onslaught of indiscriminate violence. This is when kind of the full wrath of barrel bombs and chemical weapons and sieges really gets going. And from then on, you have this really, really violent, brutal civil war that has just wreaked all kinds of devastation. And it really has not been until about 2016, 2017, where it kind of became clear that the Assad regime is going to win and retake full control at some point. It's kind of understood as just a matter of time right now. And as the civil war has continued, we've seen this proliferation in the number of armed groups. So from the perspective of a civilian, you see this conflict that looks like it's just going to drag on. It looks like the Assad regime is kind of going to just stick around. And there's a lot of confusion, misinformation, rumors, conspiracy theories, propaganda all over the place. It's really difficult to kind of know who to believe. And so you're kind of looking for anything you can to help you understand what is going on and how to survive, how to conduct your everyday life in this kind of confusing setup that also has a great deal of pessimism. from those who had hoped that the Assad regime might be replaced with a more democratic or at least more sympathetic regime to the interests of the majority of the people. We do have a particular kind of environment for civilians to select the various survival strategies that they're going to select.
Out of that, one of the key concepts that you talked about in your book was this sort of duality, this interplay of motivation and opportunity. Can you break down a little bit about how those operate within this space and how they work to inform decisions?
Yes. So the kind of classic model of migration that migration researchers in particular focus on is the so-called push-pull model of migration, where people tend to think of a set of what are called push factors, factors that motivate people to leave a place, and then a set of pull factors, factors that that motivate people to enter some other location. And as people are considering these various types of motivations, I think that we also need to recognize that motivation alone is far from the only thing necessary to make an action happen, that people also need the possibility of being able to carry out these actions that they may intend to do. Now, we are focusing this conversation right now on migration, but I would really argue that for any kind of action that somebody might choose to do, this could be during conflict or some other kind of context, you really have to both have the motivation to do it and the opportunity to execute that action in order to really carry it out.
So on the, I think in the motivation side in particular, narratives and narrative ruptures was one of the things in your book that you spent a good deal of time trying to unpack. And you mentioned it there in trying to help us understand some of the basic context of Syria. Can you talk a little bit about the research and the from the interviews and otherwise that you did with narratives?
Absolutely. So as I talk about civilians trying to make sense of what is happening amidst this really dangerous and confusing context, we are typically looking for some way to take all of the individual pieces of information that we believe and connect all of them into some story that we can tell ourselves that first makes sense of all the information that we believe and that is available to us, and that narrative will hopefully kind of fill in the gaps of information that we don't have, so that we have some kind of metric to use to help kind of order all of the information around us. And so what this turns into is that in particular, I was able to get a lot of insight into some of the kinds of narratives that a pro-government Syrian civilian might believe versus some of the narratives that an anti-government Syrian civilian might believe. Now, there are many kind of flavors of anti-government in Syria, so I should clarify here that I had the most access to people who supported more of the kind of secular component of the Syrian opposition. So think about the Free Syrian Army in particular, who a lot of international actors were hoping would become a more powerful segment of rebel groups in Syria. We have a case where if you think about how a pro-government narrative versus an anti-government narrative might understand violence against civilians taking place within Syria, your pro-government narrative is going to have you thinking that, okay, anti-government behavior is being carried out by terrorists. We have to have a hardcore counterinsurgent response to these terrorists, and any civilian fatalities that exist are really just unfortunate but necessary collateral damage on our way to pursuing our conflict objectives. If you have more anti-government leanings, you're more likely to be buying into an anti-government narrative where your understanding is generally that when civilian fatalities occur, they're really taking place out of the brutality and viciousness of pro-government armed groups, and that the suffering of civilian populations is something that is really an intentional outcome of actions from the Assad regime. Having these two kind of conflicting understandings, if you have more pro-government leanings, you may not perceive as much violent threat when you become aware of civilian fatalities as an anti-government civilian might perceive. And so just in this example, depending on which narrative you believe, you may interpret the same event, the same information, in some vastly different ways. Then, regardless of what narrative you may believe, there can be events that take place or information that you learn that directly contradicts that narrative that you believe. And this is where we have to think about whether this new information that contradicts your chosen narrative is contradicting a more peripheral piece of that narrative, so some kind of detail that is not really essential to that narrative, or whether that new information contradicts a core component of your narrative. And this is where I argue that if the contradiction is new information contradicting a more peripheral piece of your narrative, such as, say, on the pro-government side, maybe there's a discrepancy that you find out about regarding, say, the location where particular violent events have taken place. This may be something that's not really that important to you in terms of how you understand the way that civilian fatalities are taking place. And so in that circumstance, we should probably expect somebody to adjust the narrative that they believe or allow that narrative to evolve. Whereas if new information contradicts a core component, so for example, if you believe a pro-government narrative, and then you somehow come to believe a new piece of information that where, say, you learn that, wow, there's a tape of Bashar Assad directly saying some crazy thing like, let's kill all the people that we can. You may have this moment where your belief in that narrative shatters. This is what I refer to as this narrative rupture. And in this moment of narrative rupture, where your prior understanding completely just falls apart, this is a really kind of stressful time for a civilian, because you can think about how your whole kind of foundation for understanding ongoing events has just fallen apart. And so you have this sudden onset of extreme uncertainty, where all of a sudden you really kind of lose sight of what the possible set of options for action that you could take even are. And I find this narrative rupture idea really important, because as long as you have some narrative that you believe while you're living in a conflict zone, a lot of people may be able to come up with a variety of alternatives to migration, and may take a while to develop any kind of motivation to leave that area. And so this is where, when I think about when do people develop a motivation to migrate, I focus on that motivation really coming when you have a narrative rupture take place. Now, the timing of when exactly this narrative rupture happens is going to vary across people, but I think that it's really important that we think about how, as long as people set, or as long as people perceive a range of alternatives to migration, that they're often going to prefer those alternatives over the migration itself.
Can we also talk a little bit, too, about opportunity? Was there anything that stood out as striking that you learned in trying to sort of match opportunity up against when people, or how people ultimately made the decision eventually to migrate?
Yeah, so thinking about opportunity, this was something where what started to really stand out was that when Syrian civilians are trying to leave Syria, a major consideration that you have is that you're generally going to have to travel on roads. And as you're traveling along roads on land to get out of Syria, at some point you're liable to cross paths with checkpoints, spots along roads where armed groups are trying to monitor the movements of civilians. And at these spots where, as you're traveling, you come into contact in person with whatever armed group is running that checkpoint, this is a really, really dangerous interaction for civilians. And in fact, at these locations, we have all kinds of accounts of young men being conscripted into the Syrian military. You have all kinds of different kinds of human rights abuses taking place at checkpoints. And so a really important way to protect yourself is to leverage a concept that is known really through a lot of countries in the Arab world as WASTA. WASTA is this word that kind of loosely translates into English as connections. But it's really kind of more than that, because you start realizing that in Syria, at least, it kind of fits this space on a continuum between resources, which often means money, and connections, and that generally some combination of money and connections becomes really important to give you this social status that comes with having WASTA. And having WASTA becomes really valuable at checkpoints, because this is something that you can point out to a military figure at a checkpoint and make it clear that consequences will come if you harm me, so you should just let me pass. And this is something that a lot of my respondents talked about, either using their own WASTA or intentionally hiring a driver who had their own WASTA that would allow them to pass through checkpoints safely. So, for example, I have had respondents explain to me that they specifically sought out a member of the Mukhabarat, which is the secret police. And they would hire this member of the Mukhabarat to drive them, and then that person would make sure that they passed through checkpoints safely. The importance here of WASTA comes in, where people who did not possess WASTA or didn't really know any way to, say, hire somebody else who had WASTA, these folks tended to leave their homes in Syria much later than those who did have a way to leverage WASDA. And this kind of need to find status in some form becomes something that makes us reflect on how those who are able to migrate have some kind of privilege or advantage that allows it to happen. And so in a way, if you're trying to think about who is the most vulnerable during conflict, we probably need to shift our focus away from those who do migrate to some extent and think about those who want to migrate, are trying to migrate, but are unable to find a way to migrate safely.
I was actually going to ask, with your research, if there was any aspect of it that you wish you'd had more time or more resources to be able to explore. Is that an angle, or is there another part of your research that you wish you'd been able to spend more time tackling?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think that kind of a major area that I wish that I could do more with is in gathering more data specifically on a wider array of survival strategies. So in the book, I'm able to talk extensively about the strategies of migration and community support. And when I talk about community support in the book, I talk specifically about the action of sharing information with other civilians about existing security conditions. And aside from migration and community support, there are actions such as collaboration, hiding. So in Syria, there are say mountainous areas in Idlib province where there's documentation of civilians doing things like hiding in mountain caves, or in eastern Syria, people hiding in remote desert areas to avoid military patrols. These kinds of other actions also deserve to be documented and studied rigorously. And I think that this all fits into this larger picture that I'm trying to paint with my book, where there's kind of a strong tendency for analysts to think about one type of action during conflict and either explain why people do or do not choose that action. So you might be interested in migration, and you're either explaining why people do or do not migrate, or you're interested in why people would join an armed group, and you're then just looking at that kind of binary possibility. I think that we really need to put in the work to consider the full scope, the full repertoire, as I call it, of possible survival strategies, and really find a way to gather systematic data on as wide of a set of possible survival strategies as we can.
This specific research you've done focuses on one group of people in a very particular set of circumstances, but you've just talked about some of the theoretical model you've been working on. Do you see that being applicable elsewhere? Do you see that being useful in some of these other contexts? And if so, how?
Absolutely. So I would argue that there are a lot of other civil wars that kind of have enough features that are comparable with features of the Syrian civil war that it may be helpful to start trying to apply the kinds of frameworks that I use to think about survival within the Syrian civil war to survival in other civil wars. I have a little bit of discussion about war in Somalia at the end of my book, but there are plenty of others as well that we might think about. I also want to emphasize a bit here with this segue to point out that thinking about repertoires of survival strategies and thinking about the need to consider the full complexity of civilian behavior, there's a lot that we may be able to learn when thinking about responses to climate change and natural disasters. Because in these circumstances, we frequently get into conversations about why people behave the way they do, say as a hurricane is approaching Florida, or as a tornado is ripping through the Midwest. When those kinds of situations are taking place, we often kind of get public officials expressing consternation that people in these disaster-affected communities are not immediately listening to them, packing up, and moving. And I think that an important piece of understanding why the behavior of ordinary people is not as predictable as we think it should be is that we really need to understand and really respect the fact that for ordinary people, the choice is not as simple as move or don't move.
I really appreciate the time you've taken today, and I don't want to, you know, have you here all day. I do want to mention just in passing that the discussion that you have in the book on information sharing and the complexities involved and the decision making that goes on is really very enlightening. And so for anyone who reads the book, I think that in particular is something we're not able to touch on as much today, but is absolutely extremely fascinating and important. I'm curious if we circle back to the present. You're obviously with UVA's Democratic Statecraft Lab right now. Are you able to talk at all about what you're currently up to, what you're currently working on?
Absolutely. So in the book that we've just been talking about, we've been focusing on the perspective of civilians, of ordinary people, and how they are responding to the dangers that they face. At the Democratic Statecraft Lab, my focus has kind of turned to thinking about the responses of governments and non-state actors to those people who have chosen to migrate. And so I can give an example from some brand new research with David LeBlanc that we're hoping will be accepted for publication soon on the effects of border barriers cross nationally, where we end up finding kind of counterintuitively that barriers actually seem to have a positive effect on refugee flows, which is this really surprising result where kind of intuitively we tend to think that building a barrier or a wall or fence or whatever term you prefer to use at a country's border is going to inevitably reduce the quantity of migration across those borders. And I think that the fact that we actually have causal evidence to show that kind of intuitive story that people like to tell is completely wrong. I think that that's a really important insight for us to have. I would also suggest that you may actually be able to use my book to help understand this, because if you think about the choices that inform civilian decisions to migrate, it could very well be that once somebody has the motivation to migrate and the opportunity through some form of advantaged social status, you may be sufficiently determined that you're quite likely to find a way to migrate despite the construction and or existence of barriers along an international border.
Is there anything that we didn't get a chance to mention, you want to take the time now to be able to talk about, to make sure gets included.
I would definitely love for listeners to come away from this with an appreciation for the complexity of choices that people all over the world are often making. And I think that that if our conversation motivates folks to continue thinking about this and appreciating the almost ever-present existence of civilian choices and agency, I think that this interview will be a great service.